So please make sure that you have all your phone silence at this point, and I'm going to welcome Matt from Oklahoma City as our speaker tonight.
Thank you. My name is Matt Melton, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. And I'm sober since April the 28th, 1993, and for that period of time, I'm very grateful. And it's an honor and privilege to get to be here and to share with you. And I want to thank Lee for the invitation and John for being like the ultimate host. It's just been just perfect trip. It's been fantastic. And I think you're like genetically engineered to pass out chips. I mean, I just, you know, I nearly got up and I'm not due for one. And, you know, it's like an AA altar call here. And I'm glad to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a neat experience to get to come out here and share with you. And I want to thank my friend John. Where is John from Santa Barbara? There you are. Hey! And Corey for coming up from Santa Barbara, and it's nice to have some friends in the room. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what we do here. And I think about the music that we have in these rooms, and the power of God that flows through this fellowship and binds us and connects us with each other. And there's an energy in Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, this is what I wanted my whole life and never knew how to get from here to there, you know. And I'm a terrible drunk. I'm just an absolute disaster of a human being. I had a great family. My parents were just really good people. Nice people. I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. I didn't see a lot of that. My dad was a guy that, if I could sort of just epitomize as a normal drinker, he was a guy that could go to work, stay all day long, and come home and have a beer, maybe a second one, half a second one, and then he would do like ridiculous things like pay the bills or something like that. He was just one of those guys, and he got up every day, and he just kind of did the next right thing. And he was a really successful guy. He was a neat man, I have an older brother and an older sister. I'm the only member of my family that's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Only member of my family I think needs to be. And my brother showed some potential at one point, but he just wasn't really very committed, you know. I mean, he just, come on, you know, try harder. And he didn't try that hard, and so he's not here. He met a nice girl, and they started going to church, and that's it. He just kind of walked away. And my mother, I should mention, and if my brother or sister were here tonight, because this is how we do it in our family. Somewhere after the meeting, somewhere way away from all of you, they would say, come here. And they would say, Matt, you have to know that mother was an alcoholic. And I don't argue with them, but I don't agree with them either. And and for this reason, my mother was somebody that, I saw her drink a fair amount. I've seen her get drunk a bunch of times. But my mother is not like me, and for this reason, my brother got married in probably 1990, and at the wedding reception, my mother got very, very drunk, and just made a complete ass out of herself. It was awesome, and it was like, hey, you know what? This is great. We're going to not talk about this for the next 30 years. This is fantastic, and made a complete fool out of herself, and my brother, at some point during the reception, had to pick my mother up and put her in a car. And my dad was a very no-nonsense kind of guy. He was a guy who had been a World War II Navy pilot, and one of those guys. And he was a man of few words, and when he spoke, he meant it, and you knew he meant it. And apparently that night or the next morning or something, I think he like did one of these to my mother and said something along the lines of, "And that will never happen ever again. And if it ever does, I'm out of here and this marriage is over." And my mother quit drinking. You know, she just said, you know what, I'm not going any lower. You know, just like the book talks about, she was a certain kind of hard drinker. And then when the warning of her husband became operative, she was able to stop and moderate. And she completely quit drinking. I did see her drink after that, but never like that ever again. And I could see, and I saw her a couple of times drink like a glass of wine, maybe half of a second one, and then just, that's it, done. And that's not how I drink, I assure you. And, I had a great childhood until I turned about 8 years old and it kind of all went bad. I don't really know what happened. The thing is, that's funny. You know, I mean, nothing bad happened. I can't point to any singular event and say, well, that happened and, you know, nothing. I had a great childhood. But when I was about 8 years old, I'll never forget it. I was sitting at the kitchen table. We were having dinner and my dad was over here. Mom was here. Brother was there. Sister was here. And I remember looking around the table and I remember thinking to myself, man, something's wrong. And I don't know what it is. I can't tell you that. I can't articulate that at 8 years old. But man, something's bad wrong. And I don't know what it is. I can't explain that. I just know it. This cannot be right. This cannot be my family. I mean, I must be on the wrong planet. I don't know. But you know, when you're 8, 9, 10 years old, I couldn't articulate that. I couldn't explain that feeling. I just knew that it was true. And I bounced around a lot and I acted out a lot as a result of that. That feeling that I had of I don't fit in here. Something's wrong. I don't belong. I'm a round peg in a square hole. And I know that's true. That's a fact of my existence. And so I acted out a lot. I'm sure today they would diagnose me with ADD, which I think stands for alcohol deficit disorder. I mean, I just needed a scotch and soda in, you know, fifth grade and everything would have been fine, I'm sure. And I put a Tom Collins in my sippy cup and I think we'd be good. And, you know, what happened was I just felt weird. And I had this best friend of mine named Robert. And Robert lived with his dad and his parents were divorced. And his dad was cool. And his dad had a girlfriend. His dad was going to go away for the weekend. And Robert said, hey, why don't you come over and spend the night? I said, man, that's a great idea. And so I told my parents I'm going to go spend the night at Robert's house. And they said, okay, that's fine. It's in the summer. I don't remember the first time I ever took a drink, but this had to have been sometime in the first 2 weeks of June in 1979. And what happened was I went over to Robert's house and walked in the door and he said, hey, you want to take a drink? And I said, sure. I knew what he meant. You know, I was 12 years old and I thought, yeah. And he said, oh, okay. And he got down a bottle of Seagram 7, which is really, you know, primo. And we got down this bottle and he got these red cheap plastic cups. And, you know, like you get in the set if you've, you know, like you're a college kid or so, you've been through a terrible divorce and been completely wiped out. And he took these red cheap plastic cups and he poured a bunch of whiskey in one cup and handed it to me and poured one for himself. And I remember I smelled it and I thought, my God, that's awful. And I took a sip of it and I thought, I don't think I can drink this stuff. He kind of thought about that for a minute and you can see the wheels turning and he said, wait right here. And he went over to this bowl of change and ran down to a vending machine and came back with a couple of cans of Coke. And now I'm this dorky 12-year-old kid. I got a glass of whiskey in one hand, a can of Coke in the other. Now I'm thinking, now what the hell do I do? He said, well, it's pretty easy. He said, you're going to drink some whiskey and then you're going to drink some Coke. Now, I don't know how he knew what a chaser was, but he knew. I didn't know. It all made sense very shortly, I assure you. By the way, I should comment just editorially. It took us one entire week to figure out you put all that in one glass and it's way easier. And so now I'm sitting here and I'm drinking some whiskey and I'm drinking some Coke and I'm drinking some whiskey and I'm drinking some whiskey. And halfway through that glass of whiskey, the magic of alcohol happened for me. And I'll never forget it. And I had that sense, man, I started to glow from the inside out, and I had this idea that, you know what, everything is okay, and it's about to get better. And I don't know how, I can't explain that, but I just know that it's true. And man, I quit worrying about if I was on the right planet or not. And I quit wondering if I was, what am I doing in this universe? I quit worrying about all that stuff. And, because you know what, man, it's going to be okay. And you know, in my little pea-sized brain, man, I never forgot that connection between the way I feel when I feel out of place and I feel squirrely and I feel weird, less than, different from, apart from, any of that. Man, I never forgot. I know exactly what to do with that feeling. And what happened to me that night? I got absolutely rip-roaring drunk. I blacked out. I threw up. I passed out. You know, the funny thing about that blackout is, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm going to say it, so quote me on it. But I guess normal people out there, non-alcoholics, don't have blackouts. I don't know if that's true or not, but it sounds good to me. But I was really embarrassed about that blackout because, you know, it didn't seem right to me. You know, I mean, my friend would tell me stories about what happened that night, and I was like, I'd laugh along, but it's like I couldn't admit to him. I don't remember any of that. And it took me a couple of months to finally admit that to my friend. And I said, you know that thing, you know, we were down by the pool, you know, that story. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, man, I don't remember any of that. And he looked at me and he just said, well, you were drunk. And I just thought, oh, okay, I was drunk. You know, I didn't know that the abnormal became normal for me from the beginning. You know, now we talk about this. You know, one thing we talk about in our first step, we use some words that are, we talk about this word powerless. You know, and if you're new, and I know we got a lot of new people here. By the way, welcome to all the newcomers. Welcome to the new people. I'm glad you're here. We're grateful that you're here. What happened to me was that in that powerlessness is that there's two parts to that. And the first part of that is what we call this mental obsession. And what happened to me with that mental obsession is I woke up on the floor of that apartment right next to the University of Oklahoma, right near the law school. And I woke up on the floor of that apartment. And until I had about a year and a half of sobriety, I thought about drinking every single day. That doesn't mean I drank every day, but I thought about drinking all the time. That's what I wanted to do. Because, man, I had been there. What happened was drinking began to assume a more significant part of my life, and that was what I wanted to do, was go drink. You know, I didn't understand the second part of powerlessness, which we call that physical phenomenon of craving. And what happened to me was that it didn't take very long. You know, I was unaware of that in the beginning, that that's what was happening. I knew that, you know, drinking was a big deal and it was always going to be a big deal and it was something. But by the time I was about 15 years old, drinking's a really big deal. You know, I'm one of those guys that, you know, if you call me and say, hey, you know, we're going to drink this weekend, you know, that's great. Thank you for that call. I appreciate that. But we need to have a conversation about what that's going to look like. And I need to understand some things. I've got some logistical questions that require answers. I need to know, okay, well, where exactly are we going to get this? who's going to buy it? How much money do we have? What are we going to get? And where are we going to drink? I need some answers to these questions. When I was about 15 years old, I got a phone call. About 10 o'clock in the morning, it was in the summertime, and a friend of mine said, hey, we're going to meet over at this guy's house tonight, and we are going to drink. I'm like, oh, man, that's the best idea ever. I think there's going to be a bunch of beer. It's going to be great. It's going to be a great, you know, it's one of these high school, you know, blowout beer bashes. Man, all day long, I'm thinking about that. And the amount of alcohol that's going to be available to me just grows as the day goes on, right? And I said, well, what time should I get there? And they said, we'll be here about, I don't know, 8:30 or 9 o'clock. So about 5:45, I roll in, you know, I mean, this is important timing. You know, this is an important thing here. I just be of service, you know, I get there and I'm waiting around, and I mean, my mouth is watering. I mean, I want to drink, I'll never forget it. I was standing in the basement of this house, and the guy with the beer finally shows up, I'll never forget it. This guy comes down this little spiral staircase. There's six or seven of us standing around down there. And he had a 12-pack. I get mad talking about it tonight. I clearly have not really made a lot of progress on this. But I remember looking at this going, and I'm flunking out of school, and I'm thinking, okay, that's okay, one carry, that's okay. That's 1.87 beers apiece. You know, I remember getting mad about that and feeling kind of betrayed, to be honest with you. And I remember getting on my bike and just riding home. because, you know, at the age of 15 years old, I knew something about me that 90% of the people that walk this planet will never discover because they don't have it, which is that I knew that I would be more ill at ease, more discontented with 1.87 beers than with none. Right, because you're going to give me a couple of beers and you're going to get that pilot light lit and then you're turning the gas off. And that's not a good place for a kid like me to be. And so I don't like that. And I remember just going home because I know if there's not enough booze to get the job done right, there's no point in even starting. And so that is an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And I did not know that really typifies the phenomenon of craving in me, and I couldn't have identified that at the time, but that's what that was. And so if you're a kid like me, you know, you drink like I drink, what happens is, you know, I'm flunking out of school and, you know, problems are showing up and I've been suspended a little bit and I've had some issues and mom and dad said, well, you know, we were thinking that maybe it would be a good idea for you to go to this school. And I said, okay, and my brother had gone to the boarding school when he was a kid, and they said, we thought that might be a good idea for you too. And so I enrolled in Wentworth Military Academy in Lexington, Missouri. And you know, and I got to say, you know, people laugh at that, and they think, oh, you got shipped off to military school. You know, that's really not really what happened. I mean, my mom and dad loved me, and I knew that they did, and they only wanted the best for me. They could also see that I was a kid that, you know, had lots of potential, they told me all the time, but that I was absolutely just wasting away, and that I needed some structure and some discipline. And you know what? They were exactly right, and I did. And I enrolled in this military school, and shockingly enough, no one more surprised by this than me, I did really well there. And I discovered something about me that I brought into sobriety, which is that I know I do well in a structured environment, and that's why I do Alcoholics Anonymous and the way I do it today, which is that, you know, I have a home group. My home group is the Phoenix Group in Norman, Oklahoma. My home group is well aware it is my home group. Okay, I have a sponsor. My sponsor is a guy named Bob. He lives in Las Vegas. Bob is absolutely aware he is my sponsor. That does not please him, I think, probably some days, but he is well aware that he is my sponsor. And so I get to meetings. I have a set meeting schedule. I get to meetings at a certain time. I get there early. I do things. And I have to have a structured recovery program because of what's up here. Right? And without that, I have a lot of good ideas and they'll all go bad. And so I learned that about myself in military school, that I do better with structure. And so I stayed in that school for 3 years, and I did things there that my parents just thought, you know, my God, what, you know, where's our kid and what'd you do to him? You know, it's like I'm on honor roll and I'm in athletics, I'm doing all kinds of stuff I had never done before, and it was just a great experience. And I stayed in that school for 3 years, and I decided that I needed to get out of there. And really, the real story is, I wanted a girlfriend. It was an all-boys military school, and so I got to go. And so I enrolled in the University of Oklahoma and as a sophomore. And you know, all those guys I drank with before, you know what? They're all still there. And it took me about 2 whole weeks to find them. And man, the party was on, and the structure was gone. And so what happened? Basically, college can be summed up, about like this. I would go drink with these bozos. And we would go out and we would drink on Thursday night. And Thursday night, that's not like real drinking, right? That's like scouting mission drinking. You know, we're just going to find out what's happening on the weekend, you know. And of course, so we'd go out Friday night and then we drink Friday night. And of course, Saturday night's the night we would just go get rip-roaring drunk, right? That's the big blowout night. And out of that whole group of guys, I'm the only one in an AA meeting tonight. Because of not what happens on Saturday night or Friday night or Thursday night, but because of what happens on Sunday morning. And on Sunday morning, we developed this little ritual. And we called it recuperation. And I should mention that to the untrained eye, recuperating looks a lot like drinking. It's a very different activity, I assure you. And what happens is, for recuperating is, you know, we start drinking and I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous not because of what happens to me at 10 o'clock in the morning when we start drinking. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous because of what happens to me at about 11:30 or 12. when I've been drinking for a couple hours. And now, man, I'm ready to go. Man, I mean, the pilot lights, it's on now. And, you know, and these guys, they're like, okay, I'm done. You know, they're going to go, like, study or write a paper or go to work or do something normal. And, you know, by the time I was 20, well, this is kind of creepy and weird, and I don't care, I'm going to share it. By the time I was 20, I had three distinct sets of friends who were essentially unaware of each other that I would drink with. And today, I can see it as clear as day. And I would drink with these guys until they're kind of drunk out. And then I move over to this group. And then I move over to this. And I basically made like a 10-day loop around these different groups of friends. And that's what I was doing, was finding people who would drink like me. And I'm the kind of guy that, I don't know if any of you relate to this, but I'm the kind of guy that when I've had a few to drink, you know, things seem to be a good idea that just don't seem to be like a good idea any other time. And I... was drinking with a friend of mine one Sunday morning, and we were recuperating, and we were an hour or two into it, and he said, you know, I've got this idea. I said, really? He said, you know, I've got this parachute. And he said, you know, he said, I don't know. He said, people parasail behind boats. He said, why couldn't you do that behind a car? I said, I'm not sure why we're still sitting here. And, you know, so an hour later, I'm drunk in a cow pasture tied to my truck, and you know, and he walked up to me and I said, you know, I'm really not sure I understand how we're going to do this. He said, I think it's pretty simple. I said, I'm going to start driving and you're going to start running. And my sponsor said, you learned about commitment that day, didn't you? I said, yes, I learned about commitment that day. And true to his word, he started driving and I started running. And I'm chasing my truck through a cow pasture with a parachute. And I'm floating over the cow pasture. And essentially, that's my college experience. I just want to share that. I have the GPA to prove all that, by the way. And and I'm just the kind of guy that, I get itchy. And it's like, man, I got to get out of here. And I've been in this school and I'm graduating, and it's like, you know, this town is holding me back. You know, I got to get out of here. And I developed this little dream for my life. And I thought, you know, because I'm one of those guys that, man, there's something broken on the inside of me, and I've known it since I was just a kid. And, and I've looked and searched and sought after something that's going to make it better. And beautiful things in Alcoholics Anonymous and you people, I found it. And my little dream, my little fantasy looked like this. I was going to get a big job with a big company in a big city far away. And when I got there, I'd meet a girl. And this sounds good tonight. And I got a job, by hook or by crook, I got a job with a big oil company. And I moved to Houston, Texas. And it was a fantastic job. And I got there, you know, I was just a kid, 22 or whatever, out of college. And standing there at the copy machine, I'd been there a couple of weeks, standing there at the copy machine, there she was. And I walked up to her and I said hi, and she looked at me and she said hi. And that was the healthiest conversation we ever had, I assure you. And, for a few months, man, I had it going on and I knew it. You know, I mean, I had everything set up in my life exactly the way it needed to be. I knew it. I had the job, I had the girl, I had I had everything. And, you know, that was great for a few months until it wasn't. And, and I drank a lot with that, you know, that girl, and I ran around and I did a lot of drinking, and she's not one of us. And, you know, she starts asking a lot of questions about my drinking, which are annoying. And because I don't have a lot of good answers for you, honey. And but I've got one suggestion for you, which is, why don't you just stop? And so what I do is I start drinking, and, you know, you know, another thing, too, that started to happen to me about that time, too, is that, you know, is that I began blacking out all the time. And I've always been a blackout drinker, but blackouts for me started, and it kind of changed when I moved to Houston. I was drinking differently. I was drinking a lot. What happened to me was that, I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but I would black out at different points in my drinking. You know, there were nights I could go out and I could drink, and I could drink all night and not black out. And then there were times I could drink and I could just have a couple and just immediately go into a blackout. I didn't know that's a sign of ever advancing alcoholism. I had no idea. And what I would do is I would black out, and I blacked out, and it was kind of fun. It was kind of like time travel. You know, you blink and you're somewhere else. And hey, how did I get here? You know, you've been here for 45 minutes. No, I haven't. I just showed up. you know, and I'm sort of, you know, evaporating all over the place, you know, and yeah, and you know, it was, you know, it was fun, and until it wasn't, and you know, I lived there for about a year, and I got transferred to Midland, Texas, which that's not the end of the earth, but you can see it from there, I assure you, and I. And, you know, I moved to Midland. I didn't know anybody, and I hated it out there. And my drinking just assumed, as Bill's story, assumed more serious proportion. And what happened to me was that I didn't know anybody, and I just drank. And what I did was I would go to work, and I would come home, and I would drink. And I didn't really make any friends, except I had made one friend. And the guy, I met this guy, and we just became drinking buddies. And he and I would drink together, and you know, and one night, the only way to say this is he had a party in my apartment. That's the only way I can say that. I didn't know any of these people, but he had a party in my apartment, and it was pretty crazy. And there were a lot of people there, and I didn't really know them, and they were doing a lot of stuff they shouldn't have been doing, and I got very, very drunk, and I don't really know exactly what happened. I just know that at some point I kind of went away. And when I sort of rematerialized, standing in the middle of my living room in an empty apartment with everybody gone, standing there with a loaded 9mm handgun. And I don't know what happened. And I thought, you know, what I thought when I sort of came out of it, I thought, oh, they must have just moved the party to somebody else's apartment and they're still drinking. And so I thought I should go find them. And I guess I really wanted to come back because I took the gun, apparently. And And what happened was, I don't exactly remember. I was kind of in and out of a sort of a brownout, and I never did find him. But in stumbling back to my apartment, I did, however, find a Midland County Sheriff's deputy with his gun drawn. And I assure you, in Midland, Texas, you can get shot for way less than this. And now I'm sitting in jail, and it's kind of serious now. Police officers don't like that, and you know, really drunk people with loaded pistols is not really their favorite thing to have to mess with. And that guy could have shot me and filled out a form. And just like the book says, when I start to drink, I become disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. I don't know what happened that night. I really, honestly, I don't. I'd love to tell you. I don't know. But it really scared me because I knew how close I'd been. Because that guy, I mean, just for seconds and inches. If I had flinched any other way than the way I did, just dropped the gun and hit the wall, that guy would have shot me there. My parents could have been woken up in the middle of the night by a highway patrolman and a chaplain saying, you know, Mr. and Ms. Melton, we're terribly sorry, but your son was killed tonight. And you know what? That deputy, that would have been a completely justifiable shoot in my mind because I've become a danger when I start drinking. I don't know what I'm going to do when I start drinking. I've turned into that guy. And that really scared me. That incident really freaked me out. I'd never been in jail before. I ended up getting transferred to this little town in northern Oklahoma, working for that same company. And that's where the bottom really fell out for me. And I made this pledge that I wasn't going to quit drinking, but I was definitely going to not drink and, like, go out in the public, right? And that makes great sense, and you know, for a minute, until it doesn't make good sense. And you know, and my days look like this. I'd get up in the morning, and I'd get up really early. I've always been an early riser. I'd get up really early then, and I would swear to myself, I'm not drinking. I'm not drinking tonight. And I know that's true. That is a statement of fact. It's a decision. You know, I'm not drinking tonight. And I get up and I drink some coffee and I smoke some cigarettes and drink some more coffee and smoke some more cigarettes and I'm not drinking. It's not going to happen. And I go to work and I get there and I drink some more coffee, smoke some more cigarettes and I'm not drinking tonight. Maybe I go get some lunch. It's about the only thing I eat anymore. And I go eat lunch and, you know, same thing happens to me every day at about 2:00 in the afternoon. Is, you know, I just start changing my mind. And I just start trying to find a way that, you know what? You know, okay, I know I said earlier I'm not going to drink. I'm just not going to get carried away. That was my thing. I'm not going to get carried away tonight. I'm just going to go have a couple. two is a great number until you get to two. You know, and then it's, you know, well, you know, one more. And what happens to me is that I by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, my palms are starting to sweat, and man, I got to get out of there. And at 4:59 and 59 seconds, I'm clicking off the light and I'm running for the car. And as I recall it, there were three liquor stores in that town. I know there were two. I think there was a third one. And, you know, of course, I move it around because, you know, you don't want the guy that works there to know how much you're drinking. And he cares. And but for the last 6 months of my drinking, there was one liquor store that was about a quarter of a mile from my house. And it was right on this road. And you turn left right there to go to my house. And that little street I lived in, that terrible rent house. And I just stopped at that one liquor store because, you know what, it just easy. Because you know what I think? I've discovered something in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've got to surrender to the solution before I can surrender to the problem. You know, I got to surrender to the problem before I can surrender to the solution. And so what happens, I surrender to the problem and I just quit caring about, you know, what anybody would think. And I've stood at that counter of that liquor store and I've, you know, written that guy hot checks. I sat there and wrote that guy checks and I don't know how many times. And he and I both knew that check wasn't going to clear the bank. And he just took it anyway. Because you know what? That's the first place I'll go on payday. You know, I'm going to make that one right. And I've gone back out to my truck and dug for change. I've driven home and dug for change and driven back. I've sat there and pulled out every credit card I have. Those back in the day when they would just, you know, mail you credit cards, you know. And I, you know, I'll just keep pulling out credit cards until one of them hits. But I promise you, I'm going home with that somehow. And, you know, and that is what pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization looked like for me, is I just surrender to the problem. And I just, you know, if I could just stop getting in trouble, I don't care. But I'm going to go drink. And by 6:30, I'm just hammered drunk again. And earlier, you know, 12 hours earlier, I knew that wasn't going to happen. And so what happened was the end of April, last week of April, second week of April, something like that, 1993, some people I knew that I'd known in college were getting married. And what happened, the real story, I used to say it differently. By differently, I mean I lied. I used to say that they were getting married and we all went drinking. That's not exactly what happened. What exactly happened is they were going to go out drinking. I sort of found out where they were going to go and thought, hey, what a great idea. And I showed up and started drinking. And what happened is what always happens when I show up and we've been drinking. I start drinking I got really drunk and I really don't remember exactly what happened. I do, however, remember waking up in the guest bedroom at my parents' house and having one of those moments where I thought, man, ooh, this is not going to be good. And because that probably is going to leave a mark. I better get out of here. And I remember thinking, I got to go because I don't like those conversations that I know are going to happen, where someone's going to start asking me a lot of questions for which I have really no good answers and no real desire to discuss. Because there's nothing that is going to be gained from that in my mind. So I gathered up my stuff and I'm trying to sneak out of my parents' house, and I'll never forget it. My dad stopped me and he said, son, I know you don't remember what we talked about last night, but he said, I'm going to remind you. And he said, you're dying. He said, you're killing yourself and your mother, and I can't take it anymore, and we can't watch it. And he said, and we're not going to either. And he said, if you want some help, we'll do anything we can do to help, and if you don't want any help, don't come back. He said, we can't take this anymore. And because I'm that guy that'll, you know, I'll get on the phone, and, you know, I've come out of blackouts talking to my mother. You know, I mean, that's embarrassing and degrading to say that kind of thing, but that's the, you know, when I start drinking, man, all bets are off. And I know that. And so I said the first honest thing to my dad. I said in a long time to him, which I said, I don't know what I'll do, but I'll do something. And I went in the next morning and I didn't know. I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anybody in AA or anybody I did know in AA. It certainly wasn't going to break their anonymity to me. And I said, went in and talked to my boss and I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, she said, well, clearly something has been wrong with you. And she said, I don't know, we've got this counselor guy. Go talk to him. I don't know what to tell you. And so I went and I talked to the counselor guy. And I lied about my drinking. And I think he knew that. And so he said, well, try not to drink. Come back. See me tomorrow. And so I went home that night, and I got bombed. And I went back and saw him the next day, and I lied about my drink. But I got a little bit more honest, and I think he could kind of see the story was shifting a little. And I went back and forth with him a few days that week. I really don't remember. But I do remember this, the last night that I drank. I don't ever want to forget this, and I think the reason I'm standing up here tonight is it's sort of a product of that experience, which is I went home, and I started drinking, and I started drinking. And at this point in my drinking, I can't really drink hard liquor anymore. All I can drink is cheap wine out of the box because I drink hard liquor, I get really sick, and beer is stupid. So I drink cheap wine out of the box, and I drink it in one of these, 32-ounce, big gulp, cups. And I start drinking. And I had an experience I don't ever want to forget, which is that physically I got so intoxicated I probably couldn't get up and walk across the room. And mentally and emotionally, I was as sober as I'm standing up tonight in front of you. And there's a line in the book when he says, I felt as though the gates of hell closed on me with a clang. And when I read that passage, I got goosebumps in the meeting because, man, I know exactly what that feels like, because the gates of hell had just clanged on me. And there was no sense of ease and comfort. There was no relief. And I remember thinking, I'd had this psychiatrist give me these pills, and I thought, man, I've got those pills. And I took a big handful of those pills, and I wonder if I just killed myself. And I went to a very dark place that evening. And at some point in that evening, I remembered I still had that gun. And I'm one of those guys that drank to a place where I know what tears and gun oil taste like. That's alcoholism. And that's the disgusting reality of what happens to a guy like me. I wasn't raised to any of this. I mean, this is not how it's supposed to end for a guy like me. It nearly did, because I'm at the jumping off place and I know it. And what happened to me is I honestly really don't know. I guess I passed out or something. Obviously, I'm here. And I woke up the next morning, went and saw the counselor guy for the very last time. And I got completely 100% gut level honest with him about everything that had been going on. His eyes kind of got like that. He said, okay, you're going to treatment now. Go pack. And I checked into this treatment center. From that day to this day, I haven't had a drink. And I don't know how that happened. That treatment center gave me great information. They did. It was a good treatment center. They gave me great information. And they said to me some things that are just kind of AA 101, right? They said things like, go to meetings, get a sponsor, read the book, work the steps, pray on your knees, really sophisticated, stuff. And I kind of remember thinking, thank you for that, and that's a great idea. And if I ever need that, I'm probably going to do that, maybe never. And what happened is, and I want to share this tonight because there might be somebody in the room that's doing this, and I hope that this will disturb you. What I did was I floated around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I spent the next year and a half not drinking. And I did not drink, and I did not get intoxicated at all. And I didn't have a home group, and I didn't have a sponsor, and I didn't take the 12 steps, and I didn't do anything. And I just did not drink, and I'm sober now. And what happened was, for about a year and a half, I did that. My life on the outside, it got a little better. I was able to kind of get a little job, and I'd been laid off from that oil company, and I'd had this job, and it was okay. And I had enrolled in graduate school, and things were okay. I mean, on the outside, things looked like they were getting a little better. On the inside, I'm just dying. I mean, I'm dying. And here's the thing, is that I was at a point that I didn't understand. I was at that point. I think other people may have noticed this, seen this in me, but I was at this point where, the funny thing, the message I heard in that treatment center was, if you stop drinking and you straighten up, you come to some meetings, it's all going to get better. I don't know about you. I'm going to meetings and I'm not, did I mention I'm not drinking? And I want to die. You know, I mean, man, I do. I want to die, and I don't want to drink. You know, and I don't want to go back. And I had this moment where I start thinking about the gun, because that's where I go. Is I get suicidal with this, you know. And I remember I had this moment, and this thought lasted for, I don't know, a week or two. But I had this thought where I thought, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe that's it. You know, you're laughing. But here's the thing. That's a really serious thing, because here's the thing. They said, don't drink. Go to meetings. It gets better. Well, no. I'm not drinking, and I'm going to your meetings, and I want to put a gun in my mouth. That's where I am, okay? And I had this moment where I thought, maybe I'm not really one of you, because the medicine that you have is not working in my case. Now, I didn't understand. I was in no way, shape, or form taking your medicine, but it seemed on the outside like I was. And there are people like me that come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and die of this disease that are exactly at that spot. And so, by the way, if that's going through your head, come find me after the meeting. I get it. And so what happened was I got this phone call, this guy called me up, and his name was Richard. And I had drank with Richard years before, and I didn't know whatever happened to him. And turns out he's a 5-year sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he called me up one night, and he said, he got my number from that guy, Robert, that I had my very first drink with. We were all mutual friends. And he called me up, and he said, hey, listen, I was talking to Robert. He said, you're in the program. He said, you know, I've got the hotline. He said, I've got a 12-step call. Would you like to go with me? And my honest response to that with 18 months of sobriety is, what's the hotline and what's a 12-step call? Because I don't know. Because I don't have a sponsor, and that's not stuff I do. And he said, well, this guy, he just laughed. And I mean, not like a, you know, like a hateful Bob Darrell laugh, but like a, you know, like a friendly laugh. Like, ha, ha, oh, isn't that amusing? Pathetic jackass. And he said, this guy's called Alcoholics Anonymous. He's drinking. He wants some people to come talk to him. He wants some help. Now, I knew somewhere in our book it mentioned we're supposed to do stuff like that. I could have found it if you'd give me a minute. But I said, okay. I don't know why I said okay. That normally wouldn't have been something I would have responded to that with. But I said okay, and I went and met him at this terrible apartment complex. It's about 300 yards from my home group today, and we knocked on the door of this guy's apartment. And this guy opened the door, and this guy was just a mountain of a guy. He was about 6'5", 6'4", probably weighed 280. He was a Native American, full-blooded Native American, had been in the Marine Corps. And I think he and the Marine Corps had not parted on the best terms. And he was crying, and he was drinking Jack Daniel's straight out of the bottle. I sat in that room, and I listened to Richard talk to this man about Alcoholics Anonymous and the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a thought, maybe I've missed something here. And out of the three men that sat in that room, one of them's still sober. You know, we never know who's listening, and we never know who's watching. And what happened was I ended up asking Richard to be my sponsor, and he was a kind, patient, tolerant, generous, understanding, humanitarian, right up until the moment I asked him to be my sponsor. And then he wasn't anymore. And it was like this spiritual bait and switch crap. And it always involved me in some really low-level janitorial task at the group. And it just made me, I just wanted a flamethrower. I mean, I just hated it. And I had to always go clean the damn kitchen, and had to go in there with Vela, and she talked incessantly, and I just wanted to hit her with something. I smiled. That's a great story. You know something? For the first time in my life, I just said, okay, I'll do it. You know, I didn't know, man, that's step three. I just said, okay, I'll do it. I wasn't happy about it. I wasn't enthusiastic about it, but I took the action. And that was something that, you know, something I think if I'd met Richard a week earlier or a week later, you'd have somebody else standing up here tonight. And what happened to me, and I can see it today, I understood powerlessness over alcohol, but what I didn't understand was this unmanageability that is part and parcel of my life. And I mean an emotional, spiritual unmanageability, and of course unmanageable in every other way too, but specifically that. And And what happened was Richard got me into action. He got me doing stuff I never would have done. And I got to kind of plugged into that group. And you know, and the funny thing, it didn't take long. And I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And something in me shifted some tiny little bit. I don't even know. It just, you know, that compass that points in mine has just always been a couple of degrees off. And it just, it didn't go straight north, but man, it just moved a little bit. And I began to understand this. And that group saved my life, you know, and that's my home group to this very day. And what happened was I got plugged into that, and you know, and I had to watch Richard leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was really painful to watch him leave. And it was sad to watch him just get resentments and start picking fights with people in business meetings. And I can see it today as plain as day. He was just looking for a reason to leave. And he wanted the age-old tactic, which, you know, I want to leave, but I want it to be your fault. And I'm going to pick a fight with you, and then I'm going to step on your toes, and then you're going to retaliate. And then I get to leave, and I get to blame you for it. And I don't ever have to look at any of that stuff. And I watched him do that. And I could see it was weird, too. It was kind of like this out-of-body thing. I was like, watch this going, I mean, can you not see this? And he left Alcoholics Anonymous, and he died drunk. And that's sad, you know. And he hung in there for some years. And, you know, he died living around the corner from his family. And it was tough. And I had to get another sponsor. And, you know, when I was about 12 years sober, I lived in Dallas for a couple of years, and there was a man that I met there named Larry Johnson, and I said to myself, I had another sponsor in Norman, I said, you know, if I ever need another sponsor, I'm gonna get that guy. And my sponsor in Norman, he was going through some stuff personally, and for a period of time left the program, and I said, you know, I got to get a different sponsor, and I called Larry. And, you know, and Larry changed my life. And Larry said, you know, he took me back through the steps. And when I was 12 years sober, I did an inventory with Larry. And I learned things about me at 12 years sober. Man, I just missed. You know, I mean, this is stuff I just didn't get it. And that was the most impactful, most important work I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous, was that inventory at 12 years sober. So if you've got, you know, 8 months and your sponsor's pushing on you to do a fourth step, I get it. But here's the thing, is that experience changed me. And what happened is Larry and I just got as close to Larry as I did my own dad. I mean, I loved Larry. And, you know, Larry walked me through a bunch of stuff. And, you know, my mother died. You know, my parents were getting older, and you know, my dad was up in his 80s, and mom died, and that was very sudden. And about dad hung in there for 8 or 9 months, and dad he fell one night in the night and hit his head really bad, and took him to the ER, and the doctor said, "I'm sorry, but this is it." Said, "Your dad, you need to get your brother and your sister. Your dad's not going to make it." So we ended up moving him to a different hospital, and the surgeon there said, you know, "I'll do whatever you want, but there's nothing that we can really do here." And so we ended up putting him in hospice. And the night before he passed, the nurse came out of the room, and my brother and my sister and I were all standing there in the hall. And she said something. She said, "Your dad's vitals are starting to change. You know, he'd been in hospice for, I don't know, 4 or 5 days or something at this point, in a coma." And she said, "You know, tonight is," she said, "his vitals are starting to change," and said, "I don't think he's going to be with us much longer." And she said, "I think each one of you ought to take tonight and take some time, and each one of you go in and talk to your dad, because I don't think you're going to get another chance." And, you know, because, you know, I was 19 years sober, and because of the amends process, Dad and I were okay. You know, we were cool. You know, it's kind of funny enough, I had turned into that kid that they called, you know, when they need something. You know, they didn't call my brother, they called me. And they called me because you taught me to answer the damn phone. They called me because you told me, "I got a great idea, Matt. Why don't you just say yes and go do it?" So I would do that. And they called me. And God, what a blessing. But I looked at my brother and sister that night, and I said, "Look, why don't you all go on and go ahead?" And I said, I'll go away and go get something to eat or something, and I'll come back in a couple hours, and, you know, and I'll have my time with him." And And what I really wanted to do, because I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know how to walk into the room with a man that you've damn near worshipped your whole life, who's been your hero. How do you go into that room and have the last conversation you're ever going to have? And so I went over and I got in this restaurant way off by myself in this empty restaurant, and I got called my sponsor. Because I don't know what to do. But you know what? Larry Johnson knew exactly what to do. And he said, son, I'm going to tell you exactly what I want you to do. And I want you to remember this. He said, you're going to go in there and you're going to see your dad. And you're going to put your head on his chest. And you're going to hug him. And you're going to tell him that you love him. And you're going to thank him for being the man that he was. And you're going to tell him you're going to be okay. And you're going to be okay because of the things he taught you. I did exactly what my sponsor told me to do. And I didn't know that my sponsor would be in my dad passed the next day. And I didn't know that my sponsor would be giving me direction that I would use with him just a year later. And he called me up and said, son, they found a spot on my liver and it doesn't look good. And I got to go visit my sponsor on his 43rd AA birthday, which was 2 days before he died. And I got to go in and I got to hug my sponsor, and I got to put my head on his chest, and I got to thank him for being the man that he was and teaching me the things he did. And he passed. Passed a couple of days later. And I'm a guy, as you probably gathered, requires adult supervision. And I called this guy Bob that I had known years before, and I had known him most of my sobriety. In fact, he was the New Year's Eve speaker at my home group in 1994, and I'd always just kind of have this little friendship with Bob, and I called Bob and I told him what was going on, and I said, I need a sponsor, and he said, okay. And my life in Alcoholics Anonymous has been, I don't know how you get from there to here. You know, I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous, she'll celebrate 30 years in March, and I was there at the meeting when her very first meeting when she came in, and she was drunk, and she told a story about being a drunken aerobics instructor, and I just thought, you just can't make that up, you know? I mean, that's possibly the hottest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. And And we have a great marriage, and my wife is my best friend today. And we have a great marriage, and it hadn't always been perfect. I don't want to stand up here and give you a version that's always, I mean, I've been in the marriage, so it can't be perfect. Come on. We have a good marriage, and we treat each other with love and with respect. And you know what? We stay out of each other's way in the program. She's got her sponsor. She's got her people. She's got her actions, her commitments, the things she does, and I've got mine. And sometimes those two kind of mesh a little bit, and sometimes they don't, and that's okay. I'm not her sponsor. I'm her husband, and it's my job to love her and support her in any way that I can, and to be her friend and to be there for her and to support her. And, we have a great life together. You know, we don't have any kids. We got a couple of worthless dogs. And, and we just love them. And, you know, our house has kind of become the hub for some of the family, my family and her family, and holidays. You know, hey, come on over here and we'll just do dinner over here. And we love doing that. And we just have a life today that, I never could have imagined this. And I got guys I sponsor, and she's got gals she sponsors. We got a neat thing going, and I don't want to screw it up. And sitting with you people is the only thing that's allowed me to keep something like that. Because, man, I'll burn it down. I'll absolutely just burn it to the ground. And I don't want to do that today. And I'm active today. There's some conferences I go to I'm involved in. And I've learned something from every sponsor I've had in this. I've had three sponsors in this program, and I've learned something equally important and different from each one. And one of the lessons that I've learned from Bob is just this idea of just being a servant and just looking, scanning around and just looking for a job that needs to be done. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, has got enough people to just kind of show up and sit down. And, you know, that's what I did for a year and a half. when I was not drinking. I showed up and I got to meetings 10 seconds before the prayer, and you know, and I left 4 seconds when it ended. I mean, the hands drop and I'm out the door. And and the lessons that I get from Bob today are, no, you're not going to do that. You need to be looking around that room and see what work needs to be done, because it's our job to serve. It's my job to give something back to this fellowship. John and I were talking about it today, is that, I think we've got enough people that just kind of show up and I let other people do that. Okay, you can do that if you want to. I just know from my personal experience what that got me. And my life has never been better than when I show up every day and I ask God in my morning meditation, help me move from being a taker into being a giver. And that's what I want to do today. I've learned things from Bob, daily 10th step work, things like that. I've learned, and I've learned things like, things in my home group and things in my marriage positions, things that I had always held that were so important. And what I've learned today is that, you know what, if you can't be wrong, you can't be free. And I've learned today that I want it to be okay to be wrong. Because, I don't want to do that. I'm going to fight. I like to dig in. And what I've learned is, I have nothing but bad experiences every time I dig in. I don't want to do that today. I want to be somebody in my home group. I want to be a force for good. And I want to be a force for good in everything I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I may not always be able to do that, but I'm damn sure going to try. And I owe that all to rooms like this and people like you. Thanks for listening to my story.
Everybody, I'd like to thank Matt for coming all the way out from Oklahoma to share your story with us. So let's give him another round of applause.